Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a mom makes the case for free-range kids, telling parents, loosen your grip a little bit. But what about those scary headlines? First, the first Guantanamo detainee to be transferred out of Guantanamo Bay and into the U.S. justice system is being arraigned in a New York court today. Ahmed Galani was on the Bush administration's list of 22 most wanted terrorists, then classified as a high-value detainee. He arrived in New York today and is being arraigned on 286 separate counts, including conspiring with Osama bin Laden and responsibility for the murders of people killed in the U.S. embassy bombings in August of 1998. Despite being in a civilian court, there are reports that Galani will ask for a military defense team. But still, he is in the U.S., which House Minority Leader John Boehner today said is the first step in the Democrats' plan to import terrorists to the U.S. Democrats have long said that U.S. supermax prisons can safely contain terrorism suspects. Carol Rosenberg is reporter for the Miami Herald and the McClatchy newspapers and has been covering Guantanamo Bay. Carol, what do you think the significance of this arraignment is?
Well, you know, Congress had some weeks ago said to the president, don't you dare move any Guantanamo Bay detainees to U.S. soil. And here he is. U.S. Marshals picked him up yesterday or overnight at Guantanamo. And Ahmed Gailani's in New York City at the Metropolitan Correction Center, a federal lockup where other al-Qaeda suspects have been held, as well as Bernie Madoff. And he has his first appearance today in New York City, charged as an al-Qaeda terrorist on a indictment that was existing even before the September 11th attacks. They've been wanting to put him on trial in New York since 2001.
Well, in fact, four other men have been tried and convicted in New York for their role in the embassy attacks. They, however, didn't go through Guantanamo Bay. Now, the last we heard, President Obama said some of the detainees there would be tried there under revised military commissions. Because of the tainted evidence, the evidence gathered through harsh interrogation techniques. And we understood that was the concern about bringing detainees to trial in the U.S. So why is this detainee here? Why was he the one, do you think, that was picked for what everyone is saying is a test case?
This is an easy one. He was already under indictment in New York before he ever got to Guantanamo, before he was ever captured by the CIA. The federal prosecutor in New York City believed that they could try him, like I said, back in 2001 and get a conviction.
Yeah, he's already apologized for his alleged role in the bombing of those U.S. embassies in East Africa. So are you saying there's sort of a presumption that he won't get out, that he won't be the poster child for what President Obama's critics are saying is going to be a wave of detainees who will then harm Americans?
Well, they said that they could try him some years back, and I guess they believe they can get a conviction. The significance of this one is the president said he's going to look at each case. Some will go to federal trials. Some will go to military commissions. He hasn't said where they'll have those military trials. He wants the prison camps emptied by January, so the military commissions, if held, could very likely happen somewhere in the United States on a military base. But what the president has said is he's going to mix it up, release some, try some before civilian juries, try some before military juries, and this is the very first one to go federal, as it were.
And what is allegedly some of the evidence against him?
Some of the best evidence against him is a statement he made in 2006 at Guantanamo before a military panel in which he said, yes, he helped assemble the truck bombs that was driven into the U.S. Embassy in Dar es Salaam, but that he didn't realize that's what it was intended for, and that he was sorry if he had was responsible for anyone who was killed in that attack. He portrayed himself as an unwitting participant in an al-Qaeda attack back in 1998 and substantially confessed to his role in it. I don't think the problem in this case is going to be evidence. I think that they were pretty confident they could try him back with the other four men for whom they sought the death penalty and the jury gave them life. It's interesting to note that at Gitmo, when he was going to be charged before a military commission, the Pentagon prosecutors sought life. These federal civilian prosecutions leave the death penalty as a possibility in this case.
That's Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald and the McClatchy newspapers, on the first high-level detainee to arrive in the United States from Guantanamo Bay to enter the U.S. criminal justice system here. Carol, thanks so much.
Sure, no problem.
Well, if you Google the name of our next guest, the phrase America's Worst Mom pops up. Lenore Scanese received that title after she left her then 9-year-old son, Izzy, riding the New York City subway alone. The response she got, "You let him do what?" from fellow fourth grade moms and then the media, inspired her to take a deep look at crime statistics and come to the conclusion that, in her words, there are no more creeps now than when we parents were kids. And that, yes, it is horrific that even one child in 1.5 million is abducted and murdered. But parents shouldn't hold their kids hostage because of irrational fears. Lenore's book is Free Range Kids, Giving Our Children the Freedom We Had Without Going Nuts with Worry. And Lenore Scanese joins us from New York City. Welcome.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, Robin. Thanks.
Okay, tell us, the subway ride. It was your son's idea, right?
It was our son's idea. He had been asking me and my husband for us to please let him get home from someplace by himself. He really felt he was ready. And so on one sunny Sunday about a year ago, I had lunch with him at McDonald's, and then I brought him to Bloomingdale's, and I left him in the handbag department. You know, which was not a surprise for him. I mean, he knew that this was the place I was going to let him go and that he was going to have to find his way home. And I gave him a map and I gave him quarters for the phone and a subway card and $20, you know, and God forbid something happens, he needs to just take a taxi. So my twinge was just, yeah, I hope this goes well. And my God, it really did. I mean, he was so happy when he got home because he had one of those experiences that we all remember from childhood of, you know, I did it myself. I did something. I was like a grown-up.
Well, you know, and as I was reading it, I'm thinking, gee, I was just a few years older than him when I used to take the Long Island Railroad into the city to the Fox Theater by myself. But thinking about doing that today, it's a lump in your throat, and that's how people reacted to it. You wrote an essay about it, but then you're on the Today Show, MSNBC, Fox News. You're the world's worst mother. Make your case. What did you find about how dangerous it really is out there?
What I found was that there's a big disconnect between the fear that a lot of us have about how scary it is out there and how many perverts there are waiting to snatch children off their bicycles versus the reality. And the reality, as confirmed by U.S. Bureau of Justice statistics, is that nationwide, we're back to the crime level of 1970. And after 1970, crime started going up. It went up in the 70s, it went up in the 80s, it sort of peaked in the early 90s. So if you were a child, as I was, outside in the 1970s or the 1980s, and you're a parent now, your children are actually safer than we were when we were growing up, but it doesn't feel that way, and that's what we're talking about here. It feels so much scarier, and I think the reasons are pretty obvious. I mean, when my parents were raising me, you know, they were watching things like Marcus Welby, but now parents are watching CSI, and there's a big difference because Marcus Welby's people lived, and CSI, they're always being dredged out of the swamps, and we're watching the autopsies, and if that's too much, you switch the channel, and you're on Law & Order SVU with a 14-year-old dragged off the street by the Serbian war criminal who's just taking people. And there's just a big disconnect between the dramas on TV and then the stuff we see on 24-hour cable. My parents had half an hour of news at night. They couldn't cram in all these horrible stories. They didn't go to Aruba to get the latest abduction, but now they do. And if there's no abduction that day, they have no compunctions about remembering back in 1977, whatever happened to this kid or that kid. So it feels like children are being snatched off the street 24/7.
Well, so we're being battered by the media that's amplifying crime. You say, in reality, crime statistics have actually fallen in New York City. They've fallen to 1963 rates. You quote a lot of researchers in your book.
Can I quote my very favorite researcher is a guy named Warwick Cairns in England who crunched the numbers for me. You know, you always focus on what if your child is the one. How long would you have to put your child outside and keep him or her unattended for this to be statistically likely to happen?
I happen to know because it's my favorite statistic in your book, 750,000 years.
That's right. And, you know, when I ask most people, you know, the people who feel like they're being pretty conservative say, oh, maybe it would take a whole month. And then some people actually say 10 minutes and they're being serious. They really think that if they kept their kid outside for 10 minutes by themselves, that it would be very likely that they would be snatched and never seen again. I mean, I didn't even realize this was happening until I started my blog, but people are writing to me all the time that cars are going to the school bus stop And the parents keep their children in the car until the school bus comes, and then they open the car door and let their child out. And then they wait at the end of the day for the kids to come home, and then they drive them home again. And this happens even in gated communities.
Well, look, first of all, we know there are some neighborhoods that are extremely dangerous for kids. It's sickening, and that does exist. But you're talking about just across a spectrum. And I'm hearing you, and I read your statistics, and they make incredible sense. And you know what I'm picturing? Eaton Pate. This is the blonde 6-year-old who disappeared off New York streets in 1979 as he was walking to school. That's what I'm picturing. And just that one thought, or the more recent thought, how can you risk, as you said, being the parent who looks the other way, let your kid walk to school, let your kid... When you hear from parents who won't let their kids walk to the mailbox, you do and something happens.
First of all, there's no way to keep your children completely safe, and free-range kids doesn't say, you know, let your kids go helter-skelter and no matter what, they'll be safe. We believe in training kids to be assertive and, you know, not go off with strangers. You can talk to strangers, but never go off with strangers, which is a really, you know, sort of easier lesson and safer lesson for kids to learn. But the other thing is that we don't want to take a risk, but we do take risks every day and we don't think about them. If you put your child in a car, even to drive them to school, you are taking a tiny risk that you might be in a fatal car accident, and it would be, once again, something that you had done. You put your kid in the car, and now there's a fatal accident, and how will you live with yourself? And the reality is, there's actually 40 times bigger chance that your child will die that way. I mean, I hate talking about child death at all, because it makes me very shaky and upset, and I hate to think about it. But we do accept a tiny little risk in that sense, and yet an even tinier risk, a really minute chance that your child would be treated like Eaton Pate, that looms larger to us. And all I'm trying to do in the book with the statistics and reminding us that our country is sort of more obsessed about this than like the rest of the world where most children walk to school is just to try to give us a little perspective, because it's terrible to be worrying all the time and to feel like any time you don't have your eyes glued to your child, it's over.
Well, and you hold up as an example of how much things have changed a newly released compilation of episodes of Sesame Street from 1969 through 74. It's called Sesame Street Old School.
It is completely delightful because it's children romping through a vacant lot and they're balancing on like a piece of wood and they climb through a giant pipe and they're having such a great time. And obviously PBS approved this as the halcyon view of childhood in 1969. But as you put the DVD in your player, it says for adult viewing only. Because what was wholesome one generation ago is considered incredibly dangerous just a few years later.
Well, your friend worked at Sesame Street and told you they were worried about, for instance, a new girl in the neighborhood being shown around by someone else's dad. So the warning reads, these early episodes are intended for adults and may not meet the needs of today's preschoolers. Historian Peter Stearns calls this extravagant worry. We'll have more after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about free-range kids with Lenore Scanese, who cites statistics to make her case that kids are safer than when their parents grew up. And Lenore, you write a blog, and you hear from parents. Some are angry with you. And by the way, you heard from siblings of murdered children who said they felt tremendous guilt and responsibility about their lost siblings, and you helped them to understand there was nothing in each of the cases they could have done. There is no such thing as 100% safe.
I heard from two people whose siblings were abducted. And then I've also heard from some people who have had things happen to them, whether they were abused or sexually abused. And a lot of times what they're telling me is that it didn't happen on the way to school, that it happened at what they thought was the safest place. It was at home or it was at a Christmas party with their family. And of course, for every child who is abducted by a stranger, there are literally hundreds more who are hurt by people that they know. I mean, the statistics are 80 to 90% of anything that bad that happens to a kid happens with somebody they know, often a family member. And so we do get this strange view that the world is filled with strangers hiding behind bushes or criminal masterminds who are ready to snatch our children. And it's gotten to the point where in England, which I think of as sort of the harbinger of where America is going, if you want to have anything to do with children, and I mean if you want to be a teacher, a scout leader, or somebody like me, the class mom who brings the cupcakes to the fourth grade class, you have to go to the police station and get a sworn affidavit that you have not been convicted of pedophilia before you're allowed to bring the cupcakes to class.
And you know what? You're saying that is sort of, isn't that ridiculous and extreme? And I'm betting that people are hearing that and making a note and saying, great idea. We should do
move
that
to England
in our
now.
Town.
Right.
Well, and you give advice in the book as well, some terrific baby steps or big steps people can take if they want to go free range, because it'll be tough for some parents. But one is disconnect cable, get rid of it. And then, for instance, you got an idea from Richard Love's book, Last Child in the Woods. That was a wonderful book about having more nature time for kids. You say organize a neighborhood play watch group. Have parents take turns sitting on the stoop, watching everybody play in the street.
Which is actually kind of pleasant. Yeah, right. I had another similar idea, which is, you know, while all the parents are standing at the bus stop waiting for the kids to be picked up by the school bus, volunteer to watch them. And that way you start fostering a little trust again, right? Like, oh, I'm a grown-up and you can trust me and I have a kid, so I'm not probably going to kill yours. And then if they aren't ready to do that, then you flip it around and you say, okay, well, I'm going to leave my kid here. And you can watch her because there's another four of you adults and I trust you. And like I said, it's not that I promise that nothing bad will ever happen to your kid outside or inside. I mean, Elizabeth Smart was taken from her home and Adam Walsh was taken from a Sears where he was with his mom. So there's no such thing as perfect safety, but we are living in safe times. And that's what I just want us to appreciate that, because then we can give our kids the fun of childhood too, which is riding your bike, which is knocking on a kid's door without a play date and saying, why
imagine
come out
that
and play? Imagine. I mean, it sounds so radical. I mean, that's why I'm talking to you on the radio. It sounds like, what a crazy idea. Our kids can go down the block without me taking them and knock on someone's door, or they could sell Girl Scout cookies, or they could go at the park. These were things we were doing a generation ago. And all I'm saying is, if the crime statistics are the same, and they are, why can't we try to do that again?
Well, and one of the reasons is that society may not let you. You tell a great anecdote about how when your son, Izzy, was now 10 years old, he left home to go visit a friend. He takes the train there, and you get a call from the police. The conductor was outraged that the 10-year-old was on the train, and they hauled you in.
They did call me, so I said, can I talk to the conductor? But the conductor wouldn't even talk to me, right? Who was this crazy mom who put her son on the train? He wouldn't talk to me. He called the police. The police were waiting at the train station, as was the family that was coming to pick up my son, because we had organized this. They were, you know, there was a family, there was a mom, a dad, a son. And then the police called me, and I was terrified, because I thought, if they really do think I'm a crazy, negligent mom, God knows what they could do, you know, child protective services or foster care or whatever. So I was really scared. And thank God the policeman said, oh, I understand. Don't worry. Is this the family that's supposed to be waiting for him? I said, yes. The guy's name is Leo. Yes, that's who is there.
It turns out that the law says anyone older than 8 can ride in the train, so you weren't breaking the law. But it was frowned upon. And you got another letter from a parent on your blog saying that the same thing happened to her in essence. And she had to write a note and sign it and attach it to her child saying, I know my child is by himself and he's fine.
Right. You know what? I actually put that at the end of my book now. There's a little free range membership card that you can sign. And there's one for kids that says, I'm not lost. I'm a free range kid. I've been taught how to cross the street safely. I know never to go off with strangers, but I can talk to them. I like being outside and exploring the world. If you're a grown up, you probably did the same things when you were a kid, so please do not be alarmed. The adults in my life know where I am, but if you want to talk to them, feel free to give them a call. And then I have a number that they can call, and it says, thanks, have a free range day. And then there's actually one for parents, too, and it quotes these statistics that I find reassuring. It says, I am a free range parent. I believe in teaching children to be safe and then giving them the freedom we had as kids. If you think that times are more dangerous today, please take a look at these statistics. And then the three statistics I quote are 36% decline in homicides of children under age 14. That's from 1976 to 2005. Okay, that's a 36% decline. And a 60% decline in homicides of children who are 14 to 17 in that same time frame, 1976 to 2005, exactly when we think things were getting worse, they were getting better. And a 79% decline in juvenile sex victimization crimes from 1993 to 2003.
Well, and I'm sure for some listeners, there's still that little voice saying, yes, but if it's just one, I can't stand that thought. So they'll have to work on it longer. That's Lenore Skenazy, sometimes called America's Worst Mom. Her book is Free Range Kids, Giving Our Children the Freedom We Had Without Going Nuts with Worry. And for more, you can go to our website. We'll link you up to hers at hereandnow.org. Lenore, we're going to have you back because we didn't even branch out to the other fears, which is why people are able to sell us infant knee pads.
Right, because it's such a dangerous activity. Right, right, right. They're on the ground already. Hint, they're crawling.
Right. Lenore, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll dig deep into the Ricci case, the ruling from Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor that dismissed a lawsuit brought by a white firefighter. That's tomorrow. Up next, the latest news, Here and Now. In China, if you have a dispute with a relative or neighbor over money or property, it can be hard to find anyone to help you resolve it. The courts often can't or won't settle small claims. Some Chinese get so frustrated they've tried something completely different. They turn to television. Think the People's Court. The BBC's Chris Hogg reports.
Ji Chanmei made a mistake 8 years ago, and she's paying for it now. I've come to meet her at her house on Hengsha Island, about an hour by fast ferry from Shanghai.
We have four people in the family. This is my son's room. This is my daughter's room.
You're in dispute with one of your relatives over who owns the land. How did this come about?
She said when she bought this house, her relative promised to change the name on the ownership certificate. The mistake she made was she never checked whether he had or not. He hadn't. Now she's worried about the ownership of this house because that guy wants the land back now. She worried about in 10 years' time, maybe he wants this house back as well.
Mrs. Zhu's desperate to get this sorted out, but because she hasn't resorted to violence or bribery, no law's been broken. So, she says, the courts don't want to deal with it. Her only option is to try something completely different, another type of mediator. And for that, she has to get on her motorbike and travel to Shanghai. A TV studio, the countdown from the director. The titles roll, and Mrs. Zhu finds herself explaining her predicament to millions. This is a nightly show on local TV that seeks to settle arguments. It's hugely popular. The man who wants her property has his say. In charge is the self-styled Auntie Bai, a fierce judge with a no-nonsense style. She settles rows the courts can't or won't get involved in. Sometimes disputes are passed on to the show by officials, suggesting the process has their tacit approval. Outside the studio, the show's producer, Yin Qingyi, explains why people take part.
Shanghainese people don't like to wash their dirty linen in public. They don't want people to know their private issues. But these people, their incomes are low. So if, like in this case, one of them might lose their property, then there's a crisis of survival. That's why they are willing to come on the show to get the problem solved.
The arguments go back and forth for a couple of hours as the taping continues. By the end, though, Auntie Bai has bad news for Mrs. Zhu. She feels the woman's relative has the lawful claim to the land, although she says Mrs. Zhu should keep the house. That decision makes her house all but worthless, though. Afterwards, Auntie Bai explains she sees rows like this all too often.
Going to court is expensive. The law is applied without mercy. In my studio, both sides can tell their story and we can try to resolve it. It's a lot cheaper and in many ways more friendly.
In a room next to the studio, Mrs. Ju and her relatives sign handwritten agreements promising to abide by the ruling. They're not binding, of course, but the fact that many of their friends and neighbours will see the decision Auntie Bai has come to on TV will help to ensure they abide by it. Mrs. Ju isn't happy with the result, of course, but she's philosophical.
I have been cheated, and I wanted the audience to know about it and to learn from my experience. You have to be careful when you buy property, even if the person selling it is a relative.
Back in the studio, the recording of the next edition is already underway. Two-thirds of the problems people bring here are resolved, the producers say. And there's no shortage of cases, it seems, for this very public way of sorting out disputes.
That report from the BBC's Chris Hogg in China. Just ahead, should MBAs take an ethics pledge? In 30 seconds, here and now. As graduates of business schools head out into the real world, more and more are going under a new code of conduct. Nearly 20% of graduates from Harvard Business School took an oath promising to, among other things, refrain from advancing their own narrow ambitions at the expense of others. Well, maybe those students were taking a cue from the little-known but highly regarded Thunderbird School of Global Management in Glendale, Arizona.
As a Thunderbird and a global citizen, I promise.
Thunderbird is housed in a former military base outside of Phoenix, and in their May graduation ceremony, students took that oath of honor as they have for the past few years. Thunderbird President Dr. Angel Cabrera joins us. And Dr. Cabrera, can you recite the entire pledge?
I would be delighted to do so. As a Thunderbird and a global citizen, I promise I will strive to act with honesty and integrity. I will respect the rights and dignity of all people. I will strive to create sustainable prosperity worldwide. I will oppose all forms of corruption and exploitation, and I will take responsibility for my actions. As I hold true to these principles, it is my hope that I may enjoy an honorable reputation and peace of conscience. This pledge I make freely and upon my honor.
Well, the Harvard students wrote their oath. It's called the MBA Oath. Students at Columbia Business School also came up with their own oath. But we understand when you became president, you introduced the idea of an oath, you enlisted students to help you write it, and you'd done the same thing in Madrid when you were the dean of a business school there. Why? I mean, we all know post-Enron, you know, post-collapse of Wall Street, there are questions about business schools, but what did you hope an oath could do?
I truly believe that management is and ought to be treated as a true profession. And like all true professions, management ought to serve the greater good, and those who practice it ought to be well-trained and educated, not only in the techniques and the tools, but also in the principles and values of how those tools ought to be applied.
Well, and some people are saying the thinking, this new thinking, is that business school management should be treated the way studying law or studying medicine is treated. You take oaths. You understand that there's this responsibility. And we know that Rakesh Khurana from the Harvard Business School says that business schools used to teach ethics, but something changed in the 1970s. He's written the book From Higher Alms to Hired Hands. Did you feel a shift?
Rakesh Khurana is absolutely right. And I think there is a shift in business education between the 50s, 60s, and then 70s, where I think business schools try to gain respectability within the bigger university, and as a consequence, paid a great attention to building a scientific support for what was being taught. But somehow, even though there was a little bit of envy towards medicine and law and the so-called true professions, somehow we failed to apply probably what is the most important piece of those professions, which is the code of conduct, the notion of service to the greater good. No one could really imagine a medical education where one would be taught the science and the skills of medicine and not be taught the do's and don'ts and the values of practicing that profession.
And people in the profession made more money, which in some eyes gained more respect. But along with that came all the things that go with making a lot of money. But as you well know, the Purdue Business School Dean, Richard Cossier, says personal greed is responsible for what happened on Wall Street, not what somebody learned in school, almost implying that by the time someone gets to college, those values, you know, have already been instituted or instituted incorrectly. What do you think about that, that it's not the role of a business school to try to make someone less greedy?
Yeah, well, I have heard similar arguments quite often, and I don't think they're necessarily right. I mean, it is true that probably the fundamental values for each of us are developed through our childhood and youth. You may learn not to punch your friends in the nose at home, and you may learn that stealing a pencil from your friend is a bad thing. But at home, we did not have conversations about the purpose of stock option compensation or about the rules of financial reporting. I mean, they're really issues about the conduct, not of an individual, but the precise conduct of someone who's in charge of a publicly traded corporation, someone who's managing somebody else's resources, employing individuals. There's something about that specific function that is not being taught until now, either outside or even inside of the business school. And we have to use those critical formative years when someone is developing their skills to become a manager to introduce a strong sense of responsibility and, again, service to the greater good.
Can you give an example of the opposite? In other words, can you give an example of a business school teaching how to cheat? You know, how to get ahead, how to wink and nod and get around regulation.
Well, fortunately, I don't think there's any business school that teaches how to cheat. But what it is true is that many of the techniques and tools and frameworks that dominate our curriculum, they have embedded values that if they don't directly say do cheat, at least they are not helpful in preventing it. For example, when we teach human resources and organizational behavior, one of the most dominant theories is what we call agency theory that portrays managers as self-serving opportunists that will do anything they can to take profit and benefit personally from the enterprise. And because of the extension of and the popularity of that theory, then you have as a natural consequence the extension and popularity of stock option compensation plans that are intended to mitigate that self-serving opportunism that managers are supposed to have. So in a way, we have lots of theories that really are dominant in the curriculum that in some ways can become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Well, so now you have graduates who have taken this oath. How do you institute it? I mean, they're going into a field where there isn't a review board, for instance, that could remove their license, which is what can happen in law. So what good does it do if you can't really enforce it?
I'll be honest, we don't have scientific evidence that the oath in itself has made X or Y change, overall change in behavior. But we have a lot of anecdotal evidence of people who come back and say, the oath gave me the courage to speak up. When the manager in my organization suggested that we pay a search fee in country X to win a contract, I said, no, that's not acceptable. And having that oath helped me do that.
That's Angel Cabrera. He's president of the Thunderbird School of Global Management. Time magazine calls it a highly regarded, if off the beaten track, business school in Glendale, Arizona. Applicants to the school are required to write an essay discussing the ethics oath. Students talk about it in class, and then they recite it at graduation. Dr. Cabrera, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Operation Rocky Steven. Going commando from Baghdad, Iraq.
Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert, a.k.a. Stephen Colbert, aired the first of four episodes of The Colbert Rapport from Iraq last night. Decked out in a camouflage suit and tie, Colbert performed before hundreds of troops in one of Saddam Hussein's former palaces, the first time a non-news program has broadcast from a war zone. The uber-conservative Colbert claimed the war must be over because nobody's talking about it anymore and took the opportunity to declare victory. But the highlight came when President Barack Obama visited via videotape and ordered General Ray Odierno to shave Colbert's head.
General, I overheard your conversation about Stephen's hair.
Wait a second. You overheard? Are your spy satellites really that good?
No, but my ears are really that big. Now, General, as the Commander-in-Chief, I hereby order you to shave that man's head.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
Colbert said he decided to produce his show in Iraq after former Assistant Secretary of Defense Bing West suggested it on his show last year. Troops seemed to appreciate that both Colbert and Colbert came to visit. Up next, the DBs influenced bands like REM. Now two members are back, and they're next, Here and Now. Welcome back. Peter Holsapple and Chris Stamey have been playing music together since they were in middle school in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Their first major claim to fame was in the influential early 80s band The DBs. But when The DBs' shooting star dimmed, Peter and Chris went their separate ways. Peter to New Orleans, where he established a career as a sideman for popular bands like REM, a band inspired in part by The DBs. Chris became a well-known producer of other people's music. But then fortune, or rather misfortune, intervened and brought the two back together. And today, their first record together in 17 years is being released. The new CD is, frankly, brilliantly titled. It's called Here and Now, but that's not why we invited them to Here and Now. We happen to like the music, some of which survived Hurricane Katrina. Peter Holsapple and Chris Stamey join us from the Christian Science Monitor studio in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both. Welcome to Here and Now.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks for having us.
Well, and thank you for the homage. No, it wasn't homage at all. But why Here and Now? Why that title?
It's a song that I've had around for quite a while. It was always written with Chris and myself in mind, singing together, two people. He's here, I'm now.
Right. Well,
there's also the idea that we've been in a lot of bands over the years, but we're still trying to do something new every day and wake up and not live in the past.
Sort of be in the moment. Well, if you could just live in the past for just a moment, though, because we read, and those of us who've been following you know that you influence bands like REM, They Might Be Giants. The DB's name is thrown around with Velvet Underground as being, you know, sort of an influential band. Where'd you go?
Bands, like so many things, have shelf lives, and you work together for a while. Chris was with the DBs for the first 5 years. He started the band, and then when he left, I kept the band going another 4 or 5 years. And then we've just been working on lots of different projects. I had a band for about 10 years in New Orleans called the Continental Drifters. And after Katrina, I moved back to North Carolina, and Chris was 30 minutes down the road, and we thought, let's make a record.
Peter and I have been playing together in many bands. We'd have a different band every 4 months.
Name some of them, because the list is fun.
Ice.
Rittenhouse Square. Aurea Florio. No, I wasn't in that one.
No, you weren't in that one. But
well, you wrote a song that reflects some of the time that you have spent together over all these years. It's called Long Time Coming. Some reviewers are saying it reminds them of a little bit of the Everly Brothers. Let's listen to just a touch.
Back to where it all began, the fascinating whereabouts, to find so much, much later on, where you want to go.
Long Time Coming from Peter Holsapple and Chris Stamey. And Chris, the title suggests it could be about you guys getting back together.
It's a song of Peter's and one we worked on in New Orleans, but I do think it's about a time of change. When the song opens with Happy Days Are Here Again, the rest of the lyric doesn't necessarily enforce that the times are really happy. I think of that as a song that embraces both a lot of pain and the hope of another tomorrow.
It's more about New Orleans?
I think it's about surviving a time of chaos.
Which
may be us working together again. All right, I got really close to the mic on that one.
There you go.
Well, I wonder if then we should go to another song on the CD. Peter, you mentioned that you left New Orleans after Katrina.
Right.
Let's listen to a little bit of Begin Again.
Where do you go when there's no place to go back to? Where do you go to then?
Peter, tell us a little bit about that, about leaving New Orleans.
When Katrina hit, I was actually on the road up in the Northeast, and so it was a kind of disembodied experience for me. My wife and children were down there and had to escape, and we got to go back to our home in St. Bernard Parish about a month after the hurricane, and there were two contractor's bags worth of things that we could take with us. So what we learned a lot of things. I learned a lot of things from the Katrina experience. One was that I understood what's permanent. Your friends are permanent. Your family is permanent. That's the stuff that you, if you lose for good. The rest of it is just stuff, you know? I mean, I lost years worth of demos and lyrics and journals and family photographs, but I also lost an ex-brother-in-law, and that was the most important thing. And I think part of what Begin Again is about is having to make the conscious decision to not return to New Orleans. So many people did, and so many people didn't. The diaspora was so huge, it sent people in every different direction. So I now live in Durham, North Carolina, and that's a good place for me.
Well, by the way, you mentioned losing your ex-brother-in-law. That was Barry Cowsill of the group The Cowsills. You were married to his sister Susan. He drowned during Katrina. Very sad. So, Peter, misfortune drives you and Chris back together 17 years after you recorded together. Will we wait 17 for another CD?
I don't think so. I think we're going to try to keep this going. There's something about the sound of our voices together that I think is very appealing, and hopefully people will find that on this record.
Chris, there's a paragraph that I pulled. You were doing a Q&A online with some trade magazine talking about something you were working on, and in three sentences, you managed to mention the group The Rosebuds, Megafon, Bon Iver, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Zappa, Pete Seeger, The Clash is in there too. I'm just wondering, obviously you're in it for the love of music.
I like recording people who are on a mission, and it ends up a lot of times that they're in what's called indie music. They're really following their muse and not a marketing muse.
That's Chris Damey. He's reunited with Peter Holsapple. They're both formerly of the DBs. Their new CD is called Here and Now, and we'll go out on that title song. Peter, Chris, thanks so much for speaking to Here and Now.
Thank you, Robin.
Take care.
Never was a show. We could not afford to blow to bits.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
And if someone leaves this place tonight, when they were here, they sang along with us. They sang along right here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.